Welcome back to part 3, Juliette Binoche, Good, Bad, Crazy edition. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
Great. This last film we're doing, it's a bit of a, I don't know, weird one.
It's a curiosité.
Yes.
We had liberté, we had tranquillité, and now we have curiosité.
Yes.
I don't actually know if that's a French word, but...
Who cares? It sounds like one.
It's a curiosity in the sense that this is a weird-ass movie from a weird-ass filmmaker. Sean, you were the one who suggested that we have a look at Mauvais Sang. Can I ask, have you ever seen the movies of Léo Carax? Do you know anything about them?
I haven't, although I do know that Kyle Minogue was in Holy Motors. And here's a fact you didn't know, Brian.
Mm-hmm.
Kyle Minogue was in Holy Motors because Claire Denis told Léo Carax that Kylie would be perfect because Kylie was supposed to be in a Claire Denis project that failed, that never came to be. So she fobbed off Kylie onto Léo.
Wait, for real?
Yeah.
This is a real story?
This is a real story.
I certainly hope Kylie continues to work with crazy, esoteric French auteurs.
In fairness to Kylie, you know, when it comes to her filmography, she has taken a few kind of weird turns.
I mean, the only two movies I know she's been in are Holy Motors and, what's that? Moulin Rouge.
You're forgetting the most important thing in her filmography.
What's that?
Street Fighter, the movie. Along with Raul Julia.
I mean, very few pop stars have such acclaimed filmography. You know, I mean, it's only surpassed by Britney Spears with Crossroads.
Crossroads.
Friendship Never Ends. Anyway, so you didn't know the films of Léo Carax.
Not at all. Still don't really.
Yeah, he hasn't made that many movies, but each of the ones that he has made, even though they're separated by gaps, are kind of crazy, maximalist. He's kind of an enfant terrible of French cinema. The one film of his that I have seen also stars Juliette Binoche and Denis Levant, and that is Les Amants du Pont Neuf, translated as The Lovers on the Bridge, which I think actually I may have seen on my first ever trip to Film Forum, the first summer that I lived in New York. So I lived in New York. This is like, you know, a classic thing to do. You're like a kid from suburban Boston. You're in college. And one summer, you decide to live in New York and experience the life and read the Village Voice every day. But don't go to a gay club. Oh, no, wouldn't want to do that. Dream about being a priest. Sorry, everyone. This isn't my therapy session. But that was the summer of 1999 for Brian. Anyway, I went to Film Forum for the first time and just saw this movie that I'd read about probably in Jay Hoberman's review or something. And it was Lovers on the Bridge, in which, if memory serves, Juliette Binoche and Denis Levant are two kind of sexually rapacious, slightly mentally ill street people who live on the Pont Neuf and do like crazy things like dancing maniacally during a military fire parade. And like, there's also a shot that I really remember of Denis Levant running along the beach with a massive erection in long shot. It's clearly so massive that even in long shot, you're like, is that the Eiffel Tower? I thought the Eiffel Tower was in Paris, not on the beach.
You know, Brian, not unlike Mauvais Sang, Les Amants du Pont Neuf was actually a film where I'd seen that sequence before. So Léo Carax had already kind of worked his way into my YouTube history, we should say. I had marveled at that scene numerous times. And actually, just before we started recording this, we watched it again. And oh my God, it makes you think the power of cinema. Like, really, it's one of those things that makes you think this 20th century art form deserves to live forever because of what it can do.
It's funny because film does sort of different things, and Juliette Binoche is on either end of the spectrum. Like, in something like these Léo Carax movies where she's, like, literally dancing around crazily while music is blasting and fireworks are going off, you think cinema is spectacle.
Yeah.
But then in something like my beloved Flight of the Red Balloon, where it's just like a long take of her emoting in a Paris flat while someone tunes a piano, you're like, look how duration captured in cinema can take us into the fine-grained reality of human emotion.
And, yeah.
And Juliette Binoche is at le centre de tout.
You know what? Like, if anything about this podcast, why we do it, I think it's just because we adore cinema and the moving image. And, like, I realize how many hours and days I spend watching films. And, like, I think to myself, oh, God, I haven't gone out this Saturday night. And I'm like, no, Jean, but you watched A Cry in the Dark. That's good. You know what I mean? It's like...
I didn't go out my weekend.
But here's the thing. It's like, you know, I think sometimes you need a film like Moby Song or, you know, Lovers on the Bridge to remind yourself that actually, no, I am living. Mm. I'm really deathly serious about this.
I'm into it. I get it.
We it's are... like you going to see, you know, 5 hours of Fanny and Alexander by yourself, you know? That is living, Brian. That is living.
It's restorative to go spend some time alone in the dark. And, of course, it's always better when you're pretending to be a woman, which we do
on a daily basis,
on a daily basis we experience subjectivity through the lens of female protagonists.
Yes, now only this morning Brian was doing a dialogue between Barbra Streisand and Annette Bening in which I had to cover his mouth and say, Brian, I'm trying to listen to a chorus line. Will you please stop this?
You know, I have to say, Sean, it's a shame we didn't have the microphones out because that would be perfect bonus content for our forthcoming Patreon subscribers.
Yeah, forthcoming Patreon.
Okay, we've got to get back to Mauvais Song. I'm so glad that we've had this reflection. Okay, you mentioned a sequence that you had seen before from the film.
Yes.
What was that YouTube sequence?
Do you want the truth? Do you want the whole truth? Nothing but the truth?
So help me God.
Okay, so I had a boyfriend who I broke up with.
Before me?
Yes, I've had quite a few, although some of them have been demoted, do you know what I mean? Some of them have been like, he wasn't really my boyfriend.
Yeah, like, if you've only met them twice, it's not a relationship.
Darling, this is just how I live my life. Love comes very naturally to me, very easily.
Get to the YouTube.
Okay, so we went through this long period of not talking to each other, okay? But he told me that later on, he was like, I would watch this sequence, you know, regularly, and I would think of you every single time.
And the sequence is?
The sequence is from Mauvais Song. You know, you put it into YouTube and this scene pops up. Can I describe what it is?
That's what I've been trying to get you to do for the last 45 seconds.
Oh, right, okay. So in the film, you know, our two central characters are Denis Levant, that kind of jolie led, shovel face, kind of sexy, big bonered, leading actor, and Julia Binoche, who is Julia Binoche. There's a sequence where she's kind of lying in bed. She wants him to stay near her because there's a local voyeur who keeps passing by. I mean, we have the same problem on our street, really. As he's there, she says, put the radio on.
J'aime bien la radio. Il suffit d'allumer. On tombe toujours pile sur la musique qui nous trottait tout au fond. Tu vas voir, c'est magique. Attention. Pas de chance. Donne-moi un chiffre, Anna. Au hasard. Vite, Anna, un chiffre.
Quoi ?
D'accord, 3. 1, 2, 3. Voilà. Écoutons et laissons-nous dicter nos sentiments.
And then the DJ says, here is Modern Love by David Bowie. And Modern Love being one of those amazing Bowie songs that is just an unadulterated pop song, really, more than anything else, but in his inimitable style, completely intoxicating song. You know Modern Love. You know before this film, of course, didn't you?
Of course, Sean. I live in Brixton.
Okay, yes. What am I saying?
Describe what happens. I'm still waiting for you to describe the sequence.
Darling, this is why it's my podcast and not anybody else's.
It's apparently not mine either.
Well, it makes a change from you filling all the space. Okay?
Go. All right. Run. Okay. That's what happens, isn't it? Running.
As Modern Love plays, he just gets completely taken over and he runs through the streets. There's this really long kind of like, you know, like dolly shot, or else they're on some kind of like moving, some kind of track or rickshaw or some kind of
perhaps
barrow,
the back of
perhaps.
A burrow.
Okay, burrow. Furgon, you mean? Furgon, a furgonetta. And he does this amazing movement where he punches himself, he hits himself as he runs, thumping himself. But then he also does these amazing, like, running flips. And it's just stunning. And then it just ends, you know? And it's kind of like...
Well, in the real movie, he runs back to her.
He runs back to her, yes. Yeah. But what does it all mean?
Well, of course you didn't know because you hadn't seen the movie. You'd only seen this YouTube clip, which is exuberant and spasmodic and physical in all these ways.
You know, I have to say, when it came on, I couldn't remember if I'd ever never told you about this, you know, about this moment. So when the scene happened, I actually got quite tense during it.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
It was a palimpsest where one boyfriend and another were kind of layered over each other.
Yeah.
Did you like my use of palimpsest there?
Oh, I love it.
Brian's vocabulary corner.
You know, you should put a poultice on my emotions and draw them out.
A poultice.
Okay, you should put a poultice on my emotions then, whatever.
Okay, so speaking of medicine, the movie's title, Mauvais Sang, translates in literal English as bad blood.
Now, I do not know why they chose to call it... What did they call it?
Well, what's the English title?
It's like In the Middle of the Night or something, or...
In the Middle of the Night. No, Sean, it is not In the Middle of the Night. It's The Night is Young.
Okay, The Night is Young. Okay, first of all, bad blood is an alliterative two-word title, okay?
Yeah. Mauvais Sang is not an alliterative
title. No, but it's a French word. So if they were going to translate it, why don't they just go with bad blood? Do you know what I mean? In the Middle of the Night, or Let the Lovers In at Night, whatever it's called.
It's called The Night is Young.
Okay, it's really difficult to remember. Okay, I do not remember the name of that title.
As someone who strings words together and has to come up with titles for things a lot, it is the case that some things, when translated literally, do not capture whatever connotations or idiomatic overlays that the original language had. I mean, we had this discussion before when we were talking about Un beau soleil intérieur, and, like, both of these are not the worst examples of translations. I was just actually reading earlier this week about the new Christophe Honoré film, where the French title translates literally as to please, to love, and to run fast. And they've translated that as sorry, angel. Or, do you know, it could go the other way around. Do you know what the Thai translation of The Sound of Music is?
Oh, it's like the nun and the children who won't shut up or something.
If only. It's actually fairy music blows sweetly, plays here.
Oh, that's nice. But you know, the opposite is also true for English titles in French. You know, there's a whole list of the length of my arm. I think one of the most distinct examples is that Die Hard, I believe, became The Crystal Lattice.
Ooh, yeah. I like that. Do you know, I remember, I think probably this was my first trip ever to Europe when I was a teenager and we went to Rome. I was fascinated by seeing the American movie titles in Italian. I'll name the Italian title, you tell me the film. Ragazza a Beverly Hills.
Girl of Beverly Hills. Is this Clueless?
Well done.
Oh, yes. Do you have any more?
Yes, I have one more.
Okay.
Gli intrighi del potere.
Say that again?
My Italian pronunciation is probably like Gli intrighi del potere.
What is that in English, though?
The intrigue of power.
The Wolf of Wall Street.
No, babe, I was in high school, so...
Okay. Oh,
it's the
like,
mid-90s.
Goodfellas.
I have one word for you. Cocksucker.
Oh, Nixon.
Okay,
so I got one for you.
Wait,
okay?
Hold on. Just pause for a minute with the idea that the Italians were like, we can't just call it Nixon. Yeah. We have to call it Gli intrighi del potere. Yeah, what's one for me?
So, you know the film Friends with Benefits? It was an Ashton Kutcher vehicle, I think.
You know, it was originally supposed to be called Fuck Buddies.
Okay, in France, it was called Sex Friends.
There you go.
Yeah, like sex, but Sex Friends, not like Les Amis du Sexe, okay? Sex Friends.
Yeah, well, you know, the French, they preserve their language quite guardedly, but when there's an English word, like Le Weekend, for instance, and also Le Chewing Gum.
And also Fait du Shampooing. Honestly, do you know what I mean?
I do know, yes.
Okay. Je fais mon shampooing.
And now it's time to conclude our linguistic analysis portion and talk about the film. So why is the film called Bad Blood? I mean, the reason it's called The Night is Young in English, I suppose, is because this is a film which is very much concerned with youth. And actually, Léo Carax, we discovered, was only 26 years old when he wrote and directed this film.
Amazing.
And apparently was also the then-boyfriend of one Juliette Binoche.
Mm.
She is definitely admired and gawped at in this film. It's very much, you can tell, that it's a kind of muse-director relationship that's going on here.
Yeah, she is particularly beautiful. She's framed in this way that is both beyond approach and beyond reproach as well, don't you think?
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's that kind of sexist framing, really, as she's this quite beautiful, virginal, soft-skinned, delicate little darling. And actually, I don't like that.
Well, it's this kind of thing that so many male directors do, where the male protagonist of the film becomes their kind of avatar, and the female love interest is this entity that they can't have and they can't quite understand, and the camera's gaze is meant to make us feel the director's subjectivity.
Lest we forget that the male gaze is a real thing. You know, you look at this film and you knowing that, obviously, Leo Carax was getting intimate with Juliette Binoche, it's obvious. And actually, you know, when we were talking about Un Boursoulet Intérieur earlier, like, you can tell that a woman is directing this because of what she allows Juliette's face to do.
That film. I mean, that film, the subjectivity is so fascinating. And actually, it's interesting to have watched them so comparatively recently to one another, because in Mauvais Sang, the Juliette Binoche character, she's a version of a damsel in distress mixed with, like, a femme fatale. But she's this person, like, there's constant close-ups. She's like a wall that we're trying to read, we're trying to understand. Whereas in the Claire Denis film, she's also in constant close-up, but what we sense is her pain, her irony, her just, like, reaction to being bombarded by all this male attention. I think I've not seen a movie more than Let the Sunshine In, which so perfectly captures what it must be like to be a woman and every day have to listen to mansplaining. It's like mansplaining the movie.
Exactly. You know, I, of course, fell asleep during the film, but from what I did see, I would especially agree with you on that point about letting irony appear in her face. Mm. You know what I mean? You know, you said it's mansplaining the movie, and it's kind of like, you know, with mansplaining, you just have to watch it happen and let it end. Wait for it to end. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, she has that look on her face of, like, really, queen? You know?
Completely. Okay, so we've still not really explained what the premise of Mauvais Sang is and whether Bad Blood would have been an accurate title. So, Sean, why don't you take it away? Because I think, actually, when we were trying to pick the film for the third installment, when we read the plot description of Mauvais Sang, we both said instinctively, this sounds fascinating.
I want to give the back of the DVD box plot, and then I want us to figure out the actual plot together.
Yeah, okay? Because they're quite different.
Yeah, so in a kind of a near future slash a 90 degree alternative future, there is a virus that is going around that is killing young people, especially by the droves, in which if you make love to someone without loving them entirely, you will both infect each other and possibly die, okay?
It's a retrovirus.
It's a retrovirus. And we have this young hero who is tasked by these two con men who were friends of his father to break in to the pharmaceutical giant who own the cure, which they're keeping to themselves, so that they can redistribute it around the world. Okay, that is, in essence, a plot, but it's not really, is it?
Well, it's kind of like, when we read that plot, it sounds like, oh my god, this is going to be like the French AIDS commentary version of Strange Days or something. We were like, this is going to push all our buttons. The way that you've just described the plot sounds like it's going to be a caper and a heist and a kind of sexy film. It has all those elements, but I have to admit, I had a hard time getting into the tone and the pacing of this movie when we watched it a first time.
Yeah.
It may have been, it was late at night, I was trying to write down all the notes because I knew that there was no way we would remember everything. And of course, that's really tricky when you're reading subtitles and watching the images and it's dark and you're trying to write with a bad ballpoint pen.
That is true. You know, while I'm putting on my retinoids in the middle of the darkness, Brian is
frantically scribbling.
Yeah, and that's just how we live.
Yeah. But I will say that as we've allowed Mauvais Sang to seep in a bit more and thought about it, I actually do think it's a really fascinating, really worth-watching film, which clearly announces, I think this was Carax's second feature, it clearly announces a director who has an extraordinary vision that's both in conversation with previous French cinema, but also is entirely his own.
Yeah.
And it has actually an all-star cast, because it's not just Denis Levent, who is in kind of most of Carax's movies and Juliette Binoche, but also at one point we were like, oh, that's a pretty young teenage girl, and who did it turn out to be?
It was Julie Delpy.
Yeah. Julie Delpy.
Yeah. Who, I mean, Julie Delpy is gorgeous, and like, she's gorgeous at any age as far as I'm concerned, but in this, I was like, that's just a model, okay? That is just a model. She's not going to have any lines because she's just too gorgeous. But no, it was Julie Delpy.
And she actually turns out to be a really pivotal character. So Sean has explained the premise that there's this like virus and it's taking place in the near future. And Denis Levant as Alex is this kind of juvenile delinquent, yeah, who's been in jail. His dad was a kind of a bad guy who was caught up in petty crime, possibly murder, who he hasn't been in contact with for a long time. Alex is also, he's really good with his hands. He's a bit like a card sharp and a magician, and he plays all kinds of tricks. He's also brilliant at ventriloquism.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these sequences in the film where he doesn't move his lips, but his voice comes out of other people's mouths, which is clearly some kind of metaphor that we're meant to understand.
Yeah.
And so at the start of the movie, we're on a metro platform. The station is Pasteur, which we thought had some symbolism to do with medicine and, you know, infection and stuff like that. And a man falls on the tracks. That man is Alex's father. The notion is that he's committed suicide, but actually the father's former associates think, no, no, he's been bumped off by a kind of Gorgon-esque American woman.
Yeah, now, is she ever really explained properly?
Hello, Hans.
Hello, Carol.
Bonjour, Hans.
Bonjour, Boris.
C'est quoi cette épouvantable chaleur qui règne à Paris? Is it Halley's Comet? Pierre Washington.
Marc est persuadé que c'est toi qui as tué Jean.
Ah oui?
On l'aurait fait pourquoi? Les cadavres ne paient jamais leurs dettes.
Keep quiet, Boris.
Keep quiet, Boris.
Bonjour, Marc.
She's just a villain. There's
a certain school of, like, French antipathy to Americans that mm-hmm. I just, at this point, I no longer find it offensive. I just find it so funny. Jean-Luc Godard is, like, a classic, you know, exemplar of this with all his, like, 60s and 70s movies where he's denouncing America. And, I mean, granted, they were conducting war in Indochina at the time. It's just, like, making her an American woman who sometimes speaks in English and sometimes speaks in French is just, like, a shorthand for absolute capitalist greed and villainy. She, like, drives up...
repugnance.
Yeah, she, like, drives up in a limo. She looks like Lady Bracknell, like, mixed with someone from an Edward Albee play.
Well, I kind of thought it was, like, Catherine Hellman in Brazil, but with less cosmetic surgery.
Yeah, and she kind of, like, bosses around her chauffeur, and she really wants to get her hand on this cure for the retrovirus that is owned by this, no doubt, also greedy pharmaceutical company. Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, all of this makes it sound like it's going to be this crazy caper, and there are definitely elements of, like, film noir and heist that are woven through, and I think what's interesting when you consider this to be the work of a 26-year-old filmmaker, yeah, is that he's clearly in love with earlier films.
Yeah.
But interestingly, I feel like he's in love with earlier films that were also in love with earlier films than that.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Because there is that kind of Truffaut Godard homage. It's consciously kind of winking at the French New Wave. Well, I don't feel like it's trying to imitate it, if that...
Sometimes it is,
okay,
yeah.
No, there are certain scenes, but then again, I suppose he's a 26-year-old filmmaker who's in awe of the auteurs who've come before him, and he is kind of joining their club by winking at their previous
work.
Yeah,
so, I mean, in the use of montage, the use of pop music, some of the use of cutting and kind of,
very
like,
stylistic techniques, camera work.
And, of course, they were inspired by classic Hollywood cinema and, like, film noir and the work of Howard Hawks and whoever else, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's this whole kind of smorgasbord of ideas. The problem in this society is the idea of having sex or making love with someone without love. So if you don't truly love them and you have sex with them, you will infect them, is a kind of fascinating premise. I feel like if I were writing this film, I'd want to dig deeper into that. It really kind of appears and disappears in the film.
Yeah, that is my particular gripe with it, is that, like, I would have loved to have seen a film from 1986 that kind of addresses the AIDS crisis in its own kind of mildly futuristic way and is a commentary about, like, pharma greed and access and like young love and fear in a little bit more of a meatier way. And I think the elements that are more overarching in this about like loving the wrong people and the interpersonal relationships are great. I just would have liked to have seen a kind of a slight rebalance of what, you know, was more prominent in the film. And that is not a real detraction, because I think why he manages to commit to celluloid is something very interesting. I just kind of, on a personal level, wish it was a bit more the other way.
Maybe we could redo it as a stage musical.
As if you haven't got enough to do, darling.
So, I agree, because like, he's very obsessed with the aesthetics, and the aesthetics are really beautiful. But then every once in a while, certain scenes or relationships will really pop, and you're like, oh, actually, underneath all the style of this, there is something really interesting that I can relate to. So essentially, at the start of the movie, Alex, Denis Levant, has a young lover, Julie Delpy. He leaves her because he's called by his father's former associates into this job of stealing the retrovirus. But I think we're meant to understand that essentially everyone in the movie, their love is sort of misdirected towards someone who doesn't love them back. And this is a kind of classic thing that goes all the way back to like Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. But in this film, the stakes are heightened, because if you make love to someone without the certainty that they love you back, you are risking killing them or killing yourself.
Yeah. Actually, it made me think an awful lot about Douglas Sirk.
Mm.
Because that was very much a trope, both in films like Ridden on the Wind and The Tarnished Angels, and even Imitation of Life. He was always very fascinated by this idea of, like, people always love the wrong person.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that actually is a brilliant universal theme and can be the driving force of any film. And actually, that's kind of true to life, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what makes love stories interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, if two people just love each other and there's no obstacle, what's the plot?
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes there's obstacles that get in the way of people loving each other, trying to love each other. You know, when Harry Met Sally is a film about friendship being the obstacle of love in a certain regard.
Yeah,
right?
But it's also like them also not realizing that they love each other.
Yeah, but I mean, but I love the idea of, you know, a person just being, of not having that knowledge that this person who's right in front of them is the one that they should be in love with.
But I think it's also fascinating, like, if you can imagine this real world scenario, if this was really the case, like, you have an intangible quality, which is the emotion of, quote, true love. Surely we've all had coitus with people that we thought we were attracted to, or we thought we liked. Or
and then halfway through,
we're like, oh no, oh dear,
I have to come on cue immediately.
Or go. But like,
oh, is that too crass? Can I say that on the podcast?
I think you can say it's a bit of jouissance, you know?
Yeah.
We're very French here this week.
Yeah.
So Julie Delpy loves him, but he has to leave her. And actually, there's an early scene. She's clearly smitten with him. She's clearly attracted to him. She pulls out a condom, préservatif.
Yeah, I love that. I know someone who once said to me that whenever he walks around a supermarket in the UK and he's in like the jam section and everything's all like preservatives, you know, he just laughs.
Oh, the French.
Yeah.
And their ribald sense of humour. So they protect themselves in that early act of sex, but then clearly he's leaving her, and he's leaving her both because he's got this job to do, but I think he's also saying, I'm doing you a favor because I know how much you love me, and I'm leaving everything from my flat, all my books, all my possessions, over to this other kid who's a minor character but appears throughout, named Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, again, there's this like daisy chain of all the wrong people being in love with one another.
T'es mon arme encore tiède, abandonnée. Non. Oublié sur lieu du crime. Et j'espère surtout que mes empreintes sur toi s'effaceront. Je sais que ta jeunesse préservera ton étonnement renouvelé de ne pas comprendre. Et c'est bien. Je prends le large. Lise. Lise, compte pas sur le temps qui passe. Bouge vite, vite. Oublie-moi à toute vitesse. Couche avec des garçons et des hommes. Je me souviens du tout premier dessin que tu m'avais envoyé. Un des plus beaux. Avec cette phrase dessous. Quand une fille écarte les jambes, ce ne sont que des secrets qui s'envolent comme des papillons. Mais sois prudente. Pas d'amour sans préservatif.
That's when Juliette Binoche comes in the picture, and she's the kind of younger girlfriend of the older gangster Michael Piccoli.
Yeah, and she's set up actually as this mysterious figure who he sees walking through the streets,
mm-hmm.
who, like, they almost cross paths, you know, several times. And I think, you know, that is Carax being like, this is an ethereal figure of beauty who he's desperate to know, and then by introducing her into the fold as the lover of the older man, kind of puts her on a, you know, a plinth of implacability.
Yeah, and it's also like, obviously he shows up and there's this beautiful woman, Anna, that he's already seen and fallen head over heels for. Uh-huh. She's in love with the old guy.
And I think she is in love with him.
Yeah, because she has this interesting psychology that she describes. She says, I only go for men who are 10 or 20 years ahead or behind me.
I was thinking about this line earlier as we were sitting on the sofa, and I was like, what age do you have to be for that to be, you know, decent? You know, so if you're 40, okay, it means you can date a 20-year-old or a 60-year-old. But if you're 30, it means you'd be dating a 10-year-old. So,
yeah.
And she's definitely not 40.
Yeah, it's
so
confusing.
I actually think she's a pretty reprehensible, disgusting character. Well, I'm joking. Of course, she's French.
Other than that one line, we don't see her being attracted to younger people. Instead, she's attracted to older men. But it's funny because I think the implication is also that she looks to the Michael Piccoli gangster character as a kind of father protector. And she kind of looks at him longingly. She sort of says to him, say you love me, say you love me. He doesn't really reciprocate very much or even kiss her very much or seem very affectionate. So I wonder if they even have sex, because maybe they need to preserve their abstinence as well.
That is very interesting, because it's kind of about the facade. We love each other and we are together, but we cannot have sex because that would be potentially fatal.
Mm.
Imagine if you reveal the truth to someone, but you reveal the truth by an act of fatality.
Mm. No,
that is actually a pretty scary thought.
It's true, and there's also a generational divide, because they say that this retrovirus affects the young even more. And if you start to think about that, number one, I think it's because young people's passions are much stronger because they've got less life experience. They might not know what true love is because they're feeling feelings of attraction, you know, for the first time, whereas a kind of old seasoned gangster might know more or less what he feels or doesn't feel. But also, it reminds me of a Douglas Crimp essay, here we go with the queer theory, about to drop it, where he's talking about being an older gay man in the AIDS crisis and talking to a younger guy. They've gone to watch some vintage porn being shown somewhere, and someone comes in somebody else's mouth, and the young guy, and this is probably in the 80s or early 90s, says to Crimp, you know, I would love to know what cum tastes like. You think about that time period during the discovery of AIDS and HIV and all the implications of safer sex and people
and
not knowing
what
it meant.
Yeah, and what we know is transmissible and what's not.
Right, yeah. But what I'm saying is you had this older generation of people who've experienced a different kind of lovemaking that's felt more free and more able to break boundaries and be transgressive, whereas a younger generation is adjusting to loving in a climate that's possibly a climate of fear and concern.
You know, I think actually we're kind of on the edge of a new realization of the reverse of that, you know?
Mm.
It's like, not to go into conversations about PrEP, but like now that PrEP is becoming more available to people.
To affluent people in the West.
Yeah.
Have healthcare.
Yes, or people, you know, who are on the IMPACT trial here in the UK.
Right, but okay? you have to live in a country that has access to healthcare.
Agreed. I mean, it's all these caveats, okay?
Caveat.
But what I'm saying is that, like, you know, we are now entering a phase where people who are, like, 18, 19, 20 will never know what it's like to have to exclusively have safer sex with a condom. You know
what
I mean?
I mean, I think you're engaging in a little bit of utopian...
No, I am, but, I am. But what I'm saying is that, like, I think what needs to happen is there's going to be kind of a new oral history about the era of the ultra-safe sex. And obviously being on PrEP is safe sex as well. It's just that there's a safer sex on the surface and then there's a safer sex internally.
Well, it's a safer sex that allows a kind of different kind of contact than, like, say, a condom does.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all on a spectrum, but I guess, like, it's interesting that this movie is prompting us to have this kind of conversation, because clearly there's something about the premise. The more this film's concerns sink in, the more fascinating it becomes to me.
Yeah.
I think actually watching the film, it has a really strange pace that sometimes has these longueurs that just sort of seem to stretch out, and other times has like bursts of frenetic music video style action and stuff. It can take a moment to just acclimatize yourself to its rhythms.
Yeah, and I think actually that is indicative of a very young, very talented director kind of just showing off what he can do.
Yeah,
at that point. And you know what, there's zero wrong with that. I mean, his next film was Les Amants de Pont-Neuf, but that is showing off in the cinema of spectacle. Here, I think it's very much like, look how clever I can be. I sound like I'm disparaging him slightly. I don't know if I am, but certain aspects of it are too clever for their own good.
Well, let's just talk about some of the amazing set piece sequences. So you've already talked about the modern love sequence where he runs through the street. Now, I'm just going to say some of the reasons why this is amazing. First of all, Denis Levant's physicality. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Denis Levant, you described him as joli laid. He certainly is. He has that kind of almost canine face, like a dog, you know?
Yeah.
But he's also sort of squat and acrobatic. He's quite small and gangly, but like muscly. Yeah. And he has this incredible physical ability to like run and jerk his muscles around and kind of flip. And what makes it so fascinating is because, like, he's living in this gangster's lair with the girl that he loves, and he can barely touch her. She's kind of implacable as ice. He's basically blue-balled through the whole movie, and, like, that scene where he's, like, running, bursting through the streets, right, is, like, him letting off all of that energy that he can't let off through sex with her.
That's actually probably what my ex-boyfriend felt.
Well, you'd have to ask him, Sean.
Whoever he is.
But thinking also about some of the other amazing sequences and this idea of fear and risk, right? There's a whole sequence that seems to have very little to do with the plot where they go parachute jumping. Now, the one connection with this seems to be that they have anticipated that when they've stolen the retrovirus, Alex is going to have to escape to Switzerland, so therefore they're going to need to have him jump out of a plane. So for some reason they need to do a dry run from a parachute club or something. But what happens is, it's just basically an incredible excuse to do this kind of amazing scene where it, I think this is correct, we looked it up online, Denis Levant and Juliette Binoche are actually like hanging out of a real plane, seemingly at grave risk. Do you know what I mean? Because like, yeah, the character that Juliette plays, they say she's really afraid to jump.
Yeah.
Why she has to jump out of the plane, I don't really understand.
That's because Leo Carax wants to see how far he can put his actress.
And slash story. Girlfriend.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Vas-y,
Batraka! Allez, vas-y! Vas-y! Maintenant! Ne trompez pas!
But the character, like, faints and is, like, hanging, dangling, unconscious from this plane. And then the Alex character has to parachute down and grab her. And we have this amazing shot of them, like, kind of gliding smoothly and silently down in the air. It was funny, we didn't actually talk about this in the Bleu episode, but bungee jumping figures prominently as a metaphor in Blue, where she visits her mother in the nursing home and she's watching footage of people,
old people,
yeah, jumping off bridges, and here it's jumping out of planes. There is something about taking a leap, whether it's the leap into
the unknown
of the EU, or to love, or to intimacy, or whatever.
There's danger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about some other wonderful set piece scenes? I have to say, like, there's this running theme through the movie about the heat wave going on, which...
You had a real issue with this.
I had an issue. Okay. If you have characters constantly saying how hot it is, which they just talk about all the time, the first person to say it is that American woman who's like, oh, it's dreadful that there's this heat in Paris. Is it due to Halley's Comet? But some of the people seem to be wearing not much clothing. The men are constantly shirtless and looking kind of sweaty. But Juliette Binoche seems to be wearing, like, cardigans all the time.
Yeah, like long knitted cardigans.
Is that because she's somehow emotionally chilly and she doesn't feel the heat the way they all do? Oh. I don't know.
Of course, there's that lovely sequence where the pavement is so hot that he kind of carries her across it as he hops from cobble to cobble.
Yeah.
And brings her to the hotel across the way.
And why does she have to go to the hotel?
Well, it's because the local voyeur is spooking her and she doesn't want to sleep. He can't sleep with her and she doesn't want to sleep downstairs. And why can't she sleep upstairs? I don't know. I can't remember.
It's all about, like, again, it's all this idea of separation. And he's, like, doing this, like, gallant thing for her by, like, carrying her like a princess across the hot stones to a hotel so that she can sleep by herself.
Uh-huh.
Basically, after all this extended period of blue balling and beautiful sequences, there's some other amazing bits. You love the part where he tries to amuse her by doing magic tricks and juggling.
There's a wonderful scene where she's, you know, she's upset about something, and she's holding, like, tissue paper, like, or, like, napkins or handkerchiefs, you know, to her mouth, kind of, like, to muffle her laughter. But he does things where, like, you know, he'll drink a glass of wine, and then he'll, like, twist his ear, and then he'll, like, spit it out, which is, like, one of the easier natural ones to do. But then he'll do something like he'll throw an apple into the air and it'll come back down as a leek, and then he'll throw the leek into the air, and then he'll just be pulverized with other vegetables.
Tu connais le coup de la pomme? Tu connais le coup de l'ananas?
Non.
But it's fun, you know, it's this fantastical element to this already quite not grounded in reality film.
That whole middle section is kind of like sexual foreplay that's not going to culminate in any sex.
And that's damn right. This is a film where even foreplay is sublimated into other things.
Mm. Then ultimately the plot kicks in at a certain point. They're getting ready for the heist. They're going to go to the drug company to break in. But meanwhile, Julie Delpy returns. She's tracked down Alex. We learn actually that in the interim, she seems to have had a one night stand with the boy Tomas, who they left all the books in the flat to. And she feels then suddenly guilty because obviously she's in love with Alex. She had sex with Tomas. He's now infected and is kind of dying. Mm-hmm. And now she's come seeking out Alex, but Alex is in love with Anna. So it's all misplaced. They end up going to this, like, monolithic drug company where they're going to break in. And, like, again, 120 beats per minute, this is not, right? Like,
no.
Do you remember that scene in 120 BPM where they break into the pharma company? Like, amazing sequence. This pharma company is somewhere between, like, Isabella Rossellini's lair in Death Becomes Her and, like,
the monolith in 2001.
Yeah, or also, like, the space where Diana Rigg keeps the baseball diamond in The Great Muppet Caper. Shout out to listener Michael Schulman with that one. But it's like, you gotta love a movie where things are protected by lasers.
Yeah. Like, this is a diamond high sequence and not an anti-retroviral, like, smash and grab.
Describe what it looks like when he finally breaks into the inner sanctum of the drug company.
Well, it's literally a big red potion bottle that is surrounded by red lasers. It's like that sequence in Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark at the very start, you know, where he has to take the icon and put the bag of sand in its place.
So it's totally and completely, like, ludicrous and comic booky, yeah?
Yeah.
He gets this glowing red potion. He sets off an alarm. There's, like, a police sting operation. They all come running. He only can escape by pretending to have a hostage, but when the elevator door is open, he's got the gun to his own head.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's gonna shoot
himself. I don't know why they didn't just shoot him.
Yeah, I know. That doesn't make any sense. But meanwhile, he's saved by Julie Delpy, who still loves him, so he's, like, making all these sacrifices. She grabs him on the motorbike. They drive away. He then takes the potion and he hides it in a very clever manner by injecting it into an egg and then putting the egg inside a Russian doll and the Russian doll inside a safe.
Yes, just leave that one with you.
Pro tip for anybody, you know, if Donald Trump has any documents that he's trying to hide from,
check the Russian
from the
doll.
Mueller investigation, yeah. Russian doll with an egg, that is a real, real red flag.
Russian doll with no egg, just leave it alone.
Russian doll with a blini, who knows? Okay, so anyway, he's been double-crossed because the gangsters want the vial of the vaccine, the American lady wants the vial of the vaccine, there's, like, even more car chases, and this is where he's really, like, in love with all the, like, classic American film noir gangster heists, and I have to admit, it all becomes a bit crazy. He's shot by the American woman, he's still bleeding for a really long time, there's lots of ironic dialogue. Finally, at the end, nobody gets the vial. He is dying. Both Julie Delpy and Julie Binoche are kind of there. They're looking at him as he expires. He has, like, a kind of last monologue, which is all about love being like a wave that crashes and dissipates, and is this a love that burns brightly and dies too soon, da 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 da. And do you remember the last shot? Is Juliet
running. Yeah.
She doesn't quite run as acrobatically as he did earlier.
No, but there's this wonderful speeding up of the camera. Yeah. Sort of kind of bob and almost kind of blur in and out of vision.
And she's been so composed. She's contained all her desire for such a long time in the movie. And now we see her, you know, running fast. And again, it's a Godard reference. It's like, you know, where they run through the Louvre. Yeah. Mm. I mean, this movie is really, really worth watching and really fascinating. I was amazed that Juliette Binoche got a César nomination for it.
Yeah, I'm a bit baffled by that as well. Not because she isn't brilliant, but because I don't think she gets the opportunity to do enough, really. I think it might be one of those sexist César nominations. No, I'm serious. You know what I mean?
Juliette Binoche, and maybe this is the way we round out our discussion of her. Like, she has done so many different things so well over such a long career. The young woman who can be this kind of statuesque, beautiful, sexy girlfriend figure, enigmatic in this or in Damage, then becomes the same woman who can be buoyantly and cliched, cheesily, warm-hearted in Chocolat, an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, and the heart is an organ of fire, don't forget.
Yeah, but she then becomes someone who kind of can transcend all of this and become a kind of elder stateswoman of, like, feminism and, you know,
workers' rights.
But I'm just saying, like, rounded feminine psychology in nearly every movie that she now does. Like, what a career progression.
You know, I was actually a bit apprehensive of rounding off this series with Juliette Binoche, because I wasn't sure at the very start of it if I appreciated her as the way I clearly do now. You know, I know I wanted to do a non-English language actress, and I wanted to kind of explore her filmography. And actually, I sometimes think that, you know, with more challenging actresses, we've probably had more fun talking about them.
We have.
I mean, like, so my favorite episodes to make on this series actually are definitely the one we're doing right now. This whole trilogy of Juliette Binoche, Glenda Jackson, and Angela Bat. No, actually, no, do you know what? Because Strange Days was by far my favorite aspect of Angela Bassett. I think maybe, ultimately, I just need to go back into the art house and stay there for a while.
Well, you'll have a lot of time this summer to do it. Sean, I have to say, Juliette Binoche has brought out all of our favorite tropes. And this last episode, did you ever think that we would be talking about prep?
Well, we talked about the Gospels in the Glenda Jackson crazy episode, you know, and the order of them and, you know, who wrote what and what wasn't there and all that kind of stuff. So, not really, no. I'm not surprised, even in the slightest bit.
Ladies and gentlemen, we hate to love you and leave you, but that is, you know, the theme of Mauvaise Song, and it's the theme of what happens in the summer when lovers have to part. But don't worry, okay? We have more tricks up our sleeve, as Tom says, in the Glass Menagerie. Sean's favorite play.
Yeah, I hate that play. I really do.
You'll never see it again.
I'll never see it again.
Rise and shine, rise and shine.
Yeah. So, during the summer, we may pop back in your feed with a little something, something.
A little amuse-bouche, a little palate cleanser.
Yeah, but you know what? For our own sense of self-care, we're not going to tell you when it is, because we don't know what it's going to be.
Yeah, we need a break.
We need a break, a long break.
But it's also worth saying that I know a lot of you who are out there maybe have encountered us recently, started subscribing recently during our Good, Bad, Crazy time period, our Good, Bad, Crazy series. And we just want to point you to the fact that we actually have 52 episodes. So if you're...
What?
Yeah, this is our 53rd episode, yeah. And of course, some of them are three-parters. So if you're missing your broad appeal fix, go way, way back, okay? We started out just doing films of the 90s. If you want to know what we thought about Copycat with Sigourney Weaver, it's there. I'll also point you to some of...
Contact is better.
Contact is a really fun discussion.
Yeah.
Mermaids.
Evita, episode 4, back when I could remember the order of them, was, I think, our first good episode.
Yeah.
Oh, and also, our male gaze series was quite fun. We did a short series about men in cinema, mostly kind of queer theory focused. I think actually all of them are good.
Into Cruising.
Yeah, Cruising is great. Red River Written on the Wind. I think they're terrific.
Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah.
Who would have known that Al Pacino would get us so hot and bothered?
That's not hard to do.
We also did an extended series of literary adaptations.
Yeah, that was the hardest one.
If you want to know what we thought about Diane Keaton and Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Pam Grier and Jackie Brown.
Good episode. Great book. Isabel Huppert and the Piano Teacher.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The Bridges of Madison County.
Yeah, terrible book, actually a brilliant film.
Yeah, so there's a lot there to dig into.
Yeah.
We might even be curating some of our faves and putting them into the feed in kind of reissue editions. So please, please subscribe if you want to get those popping up. But if you want to seek them out yourself, the latest episodes are always up on our website, which is broadappealpod.com. But if you go to the podcast host, Podomatic, and find the Broad Appeal page, every single one of the 53 episodes that we've done is up there. You can listen to it. Please tell a friend who might like the kind of craziness that we spew out into the world. Get them hooked on Broad Appeal. It's an addiction that has no side effects. Get them to subscribe. Get them to leave a rating or a review.
Mm-hmm.
We will be back with you possibly over the summer, certainly in the future. Until then, Sean, how can people find us?
Well, listeners, it's the same old way. On Twitter, at Broad Appeal Pod, and our individual Twitter handles, Brian is at BA Mullen Speaks, and I'm at Sean McGovern X.
Sean, this has been one long, long bit of foreplay, and I think it is time that we culminate it once and for all.
Yes!
Get rid of those microphones, baby. The summer's here!
The summer's here! Tops off, guns out.
Yes, indeed. P-Town, here we come. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a blast. We'll see you sometime soon.
Bye-bye.
Et maintenant, pour Christophe qui habite le cinquième, de la part de Juliette qui habite le premier, L'amour moderne, par David Bowie.